You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Cade Young.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Wednesday, August 5th, 2020.
Later in the program, you will hear from Trudy Weddle, Vice President of Enrollment at Ivy Tech Bloomington. She talked about reopening Ivy Tech for the fall semester. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, a federal appeals court overturns John Meyer's appeal in the murder of Jill Bierman. You will hear a portion of a revisited feature where I speak with Bierman's mother, which aired on June 15th, and more on the federal appeals court's ruling to keep Myers in prison. But first, your local headlines.
Here are three headlines you need to know today. WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti filed today's local news brief.
For WFHB, this is the local news brief for Wednesday, August 5th. I'm Aaron Comforti. 740 new cases of COVID-19 were reported in Indiana on Tuesday, according to the Indiana State Department of Health, which also reported 12 new deaths over the past few weeks. Locally, Monroe County saw 5 new confirmed cases yesterday, while Lawrence County saw 3. Brown and Greene counties both reported no new cases. A City of Bloomington housing study released yesterday described the local housing market as, quote, relatively expensive. The study showed that home sale prices rose by 42% since 2012 to an average of $217,000. That rise is 16% higher than the rise in Bloomington residents' median household income over a similar period. According to USA Today, Bloomington is the most expensive city in the state of Indiana. The study did not address or even mention homelessness in Bloomington. The mom of an IU football player said that her son tested positive for coronavirus and went through, quote, 14 days of hell. She said that her son may have heart and blood complications resulting from the virus. In a viral and widely reported on Facebook post, Debbie Rucker wrote that her son, Brady Feeney, had to go to the ER because of breathing difficulties. She noted that Feeney, an incoming freshman, was in perfect health and great physical condition. Rucker wrote that her son tested negative before the season's workouts began, but that after 3 weeks, he and 3 other teammates tested positive. As has been widely reported, the positive test results forced IU to suspend voluntary workouts for 2 weeks. That's all for your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Aaron Comforti.
Lake Monroe Watershed Coordinator Maggie Sullivan presented a watershed plan update to the Bloomington Utility Service Board during their August 3rd meeting. She said a water sampling program tests water coming into the lake.
So we've been sampling the 3 major streams that flow into Lake Monroe, North Fork, Middle Fork, and South Fork of Salt Creek, along with Crooked Creek and then the tailwaters of the lake. That started in April and will continue monthly for a year. We've been collecting samples at 3 points in the lake starting in May, and that'll continue through September every month. And then our big project that we're gearing up to is we'll be doing what we call our watershed sampling blitz on Friday, September 18th. We're hoping to get about 100 volunteers to come out and collect water samples from 125 sites, smaller streams throughout the watershed.
Sullivan said City of Bloomington Utilities performed storm team sampling to gather sediment movement information. She said in January, a gauging station was installed on the South Fork of Salt Creek, where CBU is sampling. Sullivan said the Brown County Regional Sewer District is testing waters for E. coli.
They're looking in the Lake Monroe watershed and the Bean Blossom watershed, and they're going to be doing source analysis as well to try and identify if the source is human or cow or horse or wild creatures. So that'll be really good information that we hope to have later this fall.
Sullivan said court cases are still in play about the Houston South proposed logging on Hoosier National Forest land. She said anyone interested in volunteer help with water sampling can visit friendsoflakemonroe.org.
With the November general election coming soon, it is important to learn about your voting options. For the primaries, Indiana allowed for no-excuse absentee voting, which meant anyone could request their ballot by mail for any reason. It's possible to request a mail-in ballot for the general election as well. However, as of right now, you must have an acceptable excuse why you cannot be at the ballot on election day. The deadline to request an absentee vote-by-mail ballot in Indiana for the general election is October 22nd. You can find more information on voting in Monroe County, including the application for a mail-in ballot, at monroecountyvoters.us.
Bloomington Parks and Recreation Director Paula McDevitt and Director of Innovation Devot Kidd presented a staff report on the Lower Cascades pedestrian road closure during the Board of Public Works' August 4th meeting. McDevitt said the project converted Old State Road 37, which extends through Lower Cascades Park, into a pedestrian-only trail. She said the project was funded by bicentennial bonds. She presented the project goals.
The first one was to provide a much-needed bicycle and pedestrian connection from Miller Showers Park on the city's north side along Worley Pike to the Ferguson Dog Park, Griffey Lake Trails, and Cascades Park Trail. Another goal is to reintegrate the park's divided space and reinforce its identity as a destination. And then a third goal to pilot removing motorized vehicles from the road to establish a safer environment for cyclists, hikers, runners, playground users, and other park visitors.
Devitt said the project began on March 15th. She said due to COVID-19 impacts, the pilot project could be extended through June of 2021. Kidd presented data points collected from the project survey taken by park users. She said the majority of park users said they would return to the park and wanted the road to remain closed.
Prior to the pilot, again, the idea of the road conversion was really theoretical. And you can see that definitely do not want is very high. But once people who actually visited the site began to experience the pilot, then we saw the sentiment flip so that the people who definitely did want the pilot to continue, the road conversion to continue, really increased and stayed fairly steady through the course of the pilot so far.
Resident Paul Kern said the survey does not provide a question about wanting the road closed. Kidd said the survey provides questions with a spectrum answer on how much residents want to see the street continued as a multi-use path. Resident Linda Kerr discussed with Kidd about confusion concerning the word multi-purpose.
The survey we took and the ones you read to us never mentioned, do you want the road closed on a continuum or any other way?
I'm going to read the exact wording of the question that we have. On a scale from 1 to 5, how much would you like this road segment to continue to be a family-friendly multi-use trail?
That's not, do you want it closed?
So, for purposes of being able to capture that range, we want to know the degree to which you would like this to continue or not. And at one end of the scale is definitely do not want. The other end is definitely do want.
You didn't make it clear that it's about closing the road to traffic, car traffic.
Community member Greg Alexander expressed his support, saying closure creates a safer park for children.
Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton will be joining city leaders for a conference on Wednesday to answer questions about Mayor Hamilton's Recover Forward initiative. The conference will include Assistant Director of Small Business Development Jane Coopersmith, Executive Director of The Mill Pat East, and Director of Bloomington Housing and Neighborhood Development Doris Sims. The discussion will be live streamed on the City of Bloomington's Facebook page and starts at 1 p.m.
the Bloomington Redevelopment Commission approved an Economic Development Administration grant form and project during their August 3rd meeting. President of Bloomington Economic Development Corporation, Jennifer Pearl, said the grant is to provide economic recovery. She said the grant would build a technology center in the Trades District and create new employment opportunities.
The Trades District Technology Center is essentially intended to support South Central Indiana employment growth and emerging clusters and commercialization of technology. And there's really two main pieces to this. One is that there would be programming and services available to tech companies in our region to help them grow and commercialize. And then the other piece of this is a physical location in the Trades District that would serve essentially as a technology hub. And it would be serving tech companies that are anybody from just past the startup stage. So think, you know, like a graduate of the mill, for example, once they've gotten past that, all the way up to mature companies so that they can co-locate, but also have opportunities to participate in programming in this building.
Pearl said the technology center would provide jobs for recent local graduates and promote growth and talent.
AI and machine learning, big data analytics, bioinformatics, business intelligence, cybersecurity, and cloud-based services are all growing in our community and through technology coming through the university. These are all interrelated. So this center would be able to support emerging industry, emerging companies in these areas, as well as, you know, other areas of tech specialty. And if we talk about the support that the tech center would provide, it would really fall into a few main buckets. One would be to connect our growing tech companies with, you know, regional innovation assets that I mentioned, with companies that would like to acquire their technology, with IU alumni and Ivy Tech alumni, as well as with business opportunities. So one is it would provide connections. Two, we would also be looking to attract and grow talent.
Director of Economic and Sustainable Development, Alex Crowley, said 80% of the project would be covered by the EDA grant. He said the city would be responsible for approximately $2 million. He said the grant application is due in late September or early October and requires a detailed building plan. Crowley said within 90 days of submission, the city would hear a response from the grant application.
Ivy Tech Community College Bloomington reopened on Monday after being closed for 5 months due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The college said student services will remain primarily virtual for the fall semester. Entry into the building has been limited to only two doorways. Face coverings are required and will be provided at designated entry points. Ivy Tech said it will practice social distancing of at least 6 feet while on campus. Guests will not be permitted. The Blooming Foods Ivy Tech location will remain closed. Blooming Foods said, quote, "We are temporarily closed for the safety of our community during COVID-19, end quote. Ivy Tech's fall semester is set to begin on August 24th, with the majority of courses being offered virtually.
On Tuesday, I spoke on the phone with Trudy Weddle, Vice Chancellor of Enrollment at Ivy Tech Bloomington. Weddle talked about reopening for the fall semester, safety protocols, and how Ivy Tech would react to a worst-case scenario. Here is that interview. Ivy Tech Bloomington reopened yesterday. The academic semester doesn't begin until August 24th. So why reopen now?
Yeah, so we reopened our doors yesterday really to allow students who are still trying to get signed up for classes that start August 24th an opportunity to come onto campus and utilize our space. So some students may not have the technology at home to do a virtual appointment with their academic advisor or to talk to someone in financial aid or the registrar or wherever that may be. And so we have, of course, our campus set up to allow students to use our space and access that technology that they might not have otherwise. The other piece is there's some level of comfort that comes with a student being able to come onto campus and to have one-on-one support from campus staff. And so while we have a small window before our August 24th classes start, we still wanted to give students that opportunity to be able to do that.
How much of the semester will still be virtual for students?
So, our building will be open for the duration of fall unless something changes, you know, within the state and within statewide system for Ivy Tech as it relates to COVID. So the campus will be open. We will have courses that are running on campus. We actually have a nice variety of course offerings for the fall, really so that it can meet the needs of students wherever they are. So we have, you know, courses that are traditional classes, which means they'll meet on campus a couple of times a week. We have classes that are more of a hybrid model, and so they meet on campus once a week. We have courses that are completely virtual, which means, you know, students sign in at a specific time and they have real live instruction with their faculty member. And then we also have fully online. So I know, you know, right now in this area, we have a lot of schools, our K-12 schools, that may not be returning for fall. And so you have parents that maybe had thought they were coming to Ivy Tech in the fall or returning to Ivy Tech in the fall, whose plans need to change and be modified. And so those online course opportunities might be the best fit for them for fall because of that. Because with online classes, the student can really log in at the time that's convenient for them to work through their class.
What safety measures will be in place for in-person services?
Absolutely. So as with everywhere across the state, face masks or face coverings of some type are required in the building at all times. And that's true for anyone that's in the building. We have set up our classrooms so that they have socially distanced seating. So we've reduced capacity restrictions for classes. You know, classes that may have had 30 students in them in the past would now have 15 so that they can accommodate social distancing while also ensuring that a mask is being worn, in addition to ongoing sanitizing of all surfaces throughout the building. So we have quite the crew in the building that's consistently on a consistent rotation, making sure that all of our spaces are clean and sanitized, in addition to sanitation stations that are around the campus. I'm trying to think, I'm sure I'm forgetting something, but those are the big things that come to mind initially.
If an outbreak were to happen, what plans does Ivy Tech have in the event of a worst case scenario?
To the best of my knowledge, you know, like if something were to happen here in Monroe County where our campus is located, basically we would align with anything that's happening within the county that we're located in. And so Ivy Tech as a system would look at Monroe County and whatever protocol is being put in place, it would be likely that we would follow suit and potentially move things back to a virtual/online environment if needed. Which, you know, the fact that we've done that already in the spring, at least for me, it gives me a sense of a comfort, I guess, that we have done this already. And so if and when we would have to do that for fall, I think that we're in a much better place going into that than we were back in March.
Okay. And then the last question I have is, what does the future hold for the spring semester at Ivy Tech Bloomington? Have you guys figured that out yet? Or is it just kind of taking it step by step?
Yeah, so our spring course registration doesn't open until mid-September, so we still have a little bit of time to kind of get that figured out. My guess is just right now, we will have a similar approach to what we've done with fall, right? So we'll have a wide variety of course offerings from being fully on campus to virtual and then completely online, because we do know while what works for us may not work for our students. Again, just thinking like K-12, keeping that at the forefront of our minds, where we have a lot of students who also have children at home that are going to have to be working through what that may look like for them. And we want to be able to offer course offerings that fit the needs of all of our students. And so I really think that we'll do a nice job of doing something similar to what we've done with fall.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for your time, Trudy.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity for sure.
Jill Bierman went missing on Wednesday, May 31st, 2000, at the age of 19. After a long 6 years of investigation, Monroe County local John Myers was convicted for Jill Bierman's murder. Since then, Myers has filed multiple appeals to his case, his latest being filed in late 2019. Yesterday, the Court of Appeals made its final decision on the appeal, Today, we will revisit a portion of a feature published in June describing the 2019 appeal as I spoke with Jill Bierman's mother, Marilyn Bierman. After, you will hear the current ruling along with Marilyn's response. Here is the portion of that feature. Court records said, quote, "The cause of Bierman's death was ruled to be a contact shotgun wound to the back of the head, scattered skull fragments, and the presence of lead pellets in the variety of places, together with certain soil stains consistent with the body's decomposition, suggested that after being shot, Bierman's body had come to rest and had decomposed at the spot where it was found," end quote. A co-worker of John Myers reported to the police that Myers had mentioned he often hunted in the area where Jill was found. On March 13th of 2006, the Morgan County Grand Jury began an investigation in the case and found enough cause to charge Myers. In the next month, April 2006, Myers was arrested and indicted on a charge of murder by the grand jury. The trial began in October and lasted 16 days. The jury found Myers guilty, and the judge sentenced Myers to 65 years in prison.
I was glad that he was sentenced to 65 years, but I mean, it really doesn't solve anything other than at least we have some kind of justice. There's never really closure, at least in my mind. You know, people talk about, oh, the Biermans need closure. Well, that would be a nice thing, but I don't think closure really happens. You just have to learn how to deal with it in whatever way you can, and having some justice at least helps.
But that isn't where the story ends. Myers did not hesitate to begin appeal processes on the case. He went through many attempted appeals through Morgan County, the State of Appeals, and now through the Seventh Circuit. However, this last appeal was different. Myers filed a habeas corpus claiming his attorney, Patrick Baker, had failed him in trial. He stated that his defense team was careless and committed a number of errors, such as not objecting to incorrect charges or facts during his trial. He claimed his counsel did not prepare a well-opening and closing statement for his case. U.S. District Court Judge James R. Sweeney of the Southern District of Indiana approved this appeal and vacated the murder conviction against Myers. In the ruling, Sweeney wrote that John Myers received ineffective counseling from Attorney Baker at his trial. The decision meant that Myers could be released from custody unless the state decided to retry him within 120 days. Judge Sweeney then cited a disciplinary hearing to Attorney Baker, and Baker admitted to failing him in court, saying he did in fact violate Myers' Sixth Amendment rights. Marilyn Bierman said this all came as a bit of a shock.
I felt like Morgan County did everything they could to make it as fair of a trial as possible. And even last fall when this first came out that Judge Sweeney had approved this appeal, that appeal had been filed for so long. I mean, months, maybe almost a year. I don't know. I can't remember. It had been filed a long, long time, and I'd almost forgotten about it because I hadn't heard anything. So that caught me a little off guard.
Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill filed on January 8th for a 60-day extension to the 120 days that the state had to decide on a retry before the release of Myers. According to an IDS report, quote, "Approval of the 60-day extension would give Hill time to file an appeal against the September 30th order, prolonging or preventing Myers' release or retrial," end quote. During the appeals process on April 7th, 2020, Myers requested to be released from prison due to the fact that a medication he was on weakened his immune system, making him more susceptible to COVID-19. Myers was granted this request on May 9th and will be released from prison on June 15th after a two-week quarantine until the court makes a decision on his appeal. He will be released on house arrest on the agreement that he will have no contact with the Bierman family, electronic monitoring, and compliance with CDC guidelines and social distancing. At this point, I reached out to Judge Sweeney, however, I did not get past the woman who answered his office phone number. She wished to remain anonymous and to not be recorded. She explained that if no appeal of the order is made, then Myers would stay out of prison unless the state brings new charges against him. The decision of the appeal is set to come from court within 6 to 2 months. At the end of everything, Marilyn Bierman just hopes for a sense of justice.
I mean, I've been noticing a lot of people bringing up the old stories about the three who hit her with the truck and then dumped her in the creek. And then maybe he didn't really do it, but maybe he moved her body and all that stuff. People need to forget that part of the story because it was false. It was all false. Because I know a lot of people still think that's what happened, but it's not what happened. The thing that I really appreciated about Steve Sonega, the prosecutor, was he was also a really good teacher. And one of the things he did every day when he started was explain what circumstantial evidence is and why you might have that. And remind people that when a murder occurs, how many people are watching? And so unless somebody sees it happen, it's a circumstantial case. Well, if there's enough circumstantial evidence and it all points in the same direction, often plays into convictions.
Following the events of the feature segment, Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill filed an emergency notice on June 5th, ordering Myers to stay in prison until an appeal resolution was made instead of living with his mother on house arrest. Hill said the district court did not have authority to order his release despite claims of a weakened immune system. However, Myers' wait for an answer to his appeal is now over. On Tuesday, August 4th, 2020, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals overturned Myers' appeal. This means Myers' claims for an unfair representation in trial were overturned. The original conviction was upheld, and Myers will not receive another trial and will continue to serve his 65-year sentence at the Indiana State Prison in Michigan City. I reached out to Marilyn Bierman once again, who said she has been sleeplessly awaiting the appeal results.
But it is a total relief. And from what I understand, there's very little chance that this could ever go to the Supreme Court. There's like next to zero chance that this could ever make it to the Supreme Court. So maybe we really are finally done. I mean, we're never really done, but it's just a big relief and a big weight off my shoulders.
According to a WTIU news report, Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill said in a statement, quote, he believes today's decision will be the final word on Myers' appeal, end quote. Marilyn said with this ruling, she felt like all victims of the case finally found a sense of justice in Jill's story.
It seemed like there was very little, if any, concern for victims. I think that was the part about this that kind of hurt the most. And victims are not just Jill. It's anyone and everyone, whoever knew Jill or who knows us, her family, her friends. I mean, everybody's a victim here. And victims have rights, too. So just respect for and concern and care for people who are victims. And it feels good that there is justice for Jill.
For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Aaron Comforti, Jake Jacobson, and Sydney Foreman in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our features were produced by Sydney Foreman and myself.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Our executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
And I'm Cade Young. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent local news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as other WFHB news programming at WFHB.org.
You too can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for cool solutions coming up next on WFHB Community Radio.